Welcome to the Decent Crypto Podcast. Today is Tuesday, November 22nd, and we are live with a very special episode, the Decent Deep Dive on the one and only Bitcoin. Matt, how you feeling?
I am so fucking hyped, man. I love Bitcoin. Like, you know, we've had a really tough couple of weeks in crypto. And whenever I'm feeling down on the space in general, I go back and I read the Bitcoin or the Bitcoin white paper. And that tends to solve it. You know, it's very healing. I think for a lot of people, they turn to, in times of stress, they turn to the Bible, the Torah, the Quran. I turn to the Bitcoin white paper. Let's get into Bitcoin.
It's time for some healing, Matt. Let's start at the top. The abstract. A purely peer-to-peer version of electronic cash would allow online payments to be sent directly from one party to another without going through a financial institution. Digital signatures provide part of the solution, but the main benefits are lost if a trusted third party is still required to prevent double spending. We propose a solution to the double spending problem using a peer-to-peer network. Written by Satoshi Nakamoto in 2008. Now, Matt, where to even begin?
I think we should talk about, you know, prior attempts at digital currency, right? Because Bitcoin wasn't the first.
So let's start where we always start, Matt. Why does this exist, right? Like, why does this even exist in the first place, right? The white paper starts with a purely peer-to-peer version of electronic cash would allow online payments to be sent directly from one party to another without going through a financial institution. So, like, why do you want something like that in the first place, right? Like, what's the need?
So commerce, you know, largely by 2008 had shifted to heavy use of digital commerce systems, right? We moved from this world of cash to this world of credit cards, this world of online payments.
And this is definitely applies to like retail commerce, right? Like us buying stuff on Amazon, like Amazon was a massive thing. Online shopping was a massive thing, but it also applies to stuff like payments and international settlements and, things like banking and, central banking. All of that or a lot of that had already gone digital by 2008.
Yeah. So in the physical world, you have physical cash, right? It's irreversible. It can be peer-to-peer. And you know, it's trustless, right? Like cash changes hands and the good or service is paid for. In the digital world, Satoshi argues that, that in order to like make electronic payments as of 2008, you only had one option, which was to go through a trusted third party. The issue there is that you don't have that irreversible settlement, right? The trusted third party can do whatever they want, right? They're the ones that control the ledger. They're the ones that control the balances. They also wind up acting as a point of trust. So when you have like chargebacks for a merchant, right, because of like fraud, somebody has to put the bill for that. And usually that's the trusted third party. And so these intermediaries take fees. They also make it so that you can't, so that, you know, micropayments effectively become fiscally infeasible just because, you know, after the fee, it doesn't make sense to send a transaction of one penny or whatever. And Satoshi points out that we need a verifiable version of peer-to-peer electronic cash. And so that's why Bitcoin's white paper is titled Bitcoin, a peer-to-peer electronic cash system. There's other sort of more philosophical principles involved here, though, right?
Yeah, there are. So there's a big background around this, right? Like people have been trying to make digital currencies, digital cash for a long time, starting in the 90s, right? There is a whole movement called the cypherpunk movement that was really trying to embody certain principles around making a digital kind of like an open digital space, centered around things like privacy, like anonymity, digital cash that was, decentralized, like decentralization was a big principle. A lot of this is captured in what's known as a Cypherpunk's Manifesto. This was something written by Eric Hughes in 1993. This guy from Berkeley, shout out Cal Berkeley. Go Bears. So the Cypherpunk Manifesto is really laying out a vision for the future of the internet using things like digital signatures and, you know, cryptography to enable people to interact anonymously and have these kinds of digital cash systems. So I'll read a little bit from a Cypherpunk's Manifesto. Privacy is necessary for an open society in the digital age. Privacy is not secrecy. Private matter is something one doesn't want the whole world to know, but a secret matter is something one doesn't want anybody to know. Privacy is the power to selectively reveal oneself to the world. So he gets into why electronic cash is a really big part of this. So privacy in an open system requires anonymous transaction systems. Until now, cash has been the primary system. Anonymous transaction system is not a secret transaction system. It empowers individuals to reveal their identity when desired and only when desired. This is the essence of privacy. So this kind of movement started way back in the 90s, right? And like people have made attempts at trying to build this using cryptography, going back to the very first attempts. I think the very first attempt ever was by David Chaum and Stefan Brands, this thing called eCash. So they, had built this thing in the early 90s. It got shut down because I think they got shut down by some part of the government. It really was because they were like publicly known as the founders of this thing. There was Adam Back, who created Hashcash, who is also one of the founders of Blockstream, one of the biggest Bitcoin like development companies out there. So Adam Back was working on this stuff in the 90s. Hashcash was one of the first things that implemented what's known as proof of work. So proof of work is the underlying consensus mechanism that Bitcoin uses to secure its network, to secure its protocol. And that was not invented necessarily by Satoshi. It was invented back in the 90s. Adam Back had an implementation of it. There was an implementation going even further back, like as far as 1992. So there was another implementation of a digital currency called B-Money by this guy named Wei Dai. And another one called BitGold by Nick Szabo. Nick Szabo, another very prominent Bitcoin figure. He's written a ton of blogs around like Bitcoin philosophy or just like cryptocurrency philosophy. He's kind of a polymath. Would definitely check out his blogs if you don't know who he is. The point of all these things is that the technology, the like kind of the technological underpinnings of what makes Bitcoin what it is and the philosophies behind it have been in the works for decades now, since the early 90s, right? People have been writing about this. People have been implementing the code. And really none of them reached escape velocity. You could say none of them really gained any kind of critical mass for the most part. Two reasons, I would say. Like one is that the technology was never really robust enough to withstand substantial attacks. And the second part being that it was easy to shut them down on a social level because the founders were always out in the open, publicly known. Any kind of government agency could go after them, shut them down, force them to close the network down. They weren't really decentralized, as we would say today. So that's a little bit of the historical background before Bitcoin, right? Before Satoshi releases this white paper in 2008, the first block gets mined in 2009, January 3rd of 2009. This is kind of what is the backdrop behind Bitcoin?
That's pretty, it's pretty interesting, right? Because you can see how like Bitcoin is known for its decentralization, but you can also see why decentralization is necessary for Bitcoin, right? Mm-hmm. So
there are two things I think there that are worth highlighting that I don't think Bitcoin could have survived without. One is anonymity. I don't think without Satoshi's anonymity, Bitcoin could have survived. And I don't think without sufficient decentralization, Bitcoin could have survived, right? And they kind of go hand in hand because initially Satoshi was like the majority of the mining power in the network, right? So it was a completely centralized network. It wasn't really decentralized. Like it was open source code, but he was really the only person like supporting it. But he wasn't a known entity, right? So nobody could say like, yo, you have to shut this down, right? So they kind of go hand in hand there. But I think those are the two key components that are really worth highlighting there. And then the third, and I think this is kind of the phase we'll move into next, is proof of work, right? Proof of work was something really fundamental that was invented, already existed, that Satoshi used. Satoshi references a lot of these works in the white paper. So he references Hal Finney, who was working on this in the 90s. He references Adam Back. He references Wei Dai. So these are all things that are referenced in the white paper and like are building blocks for the protocol.
Why don't we get into what proof of work is now? What do you say?
So let's break down how Bitcoin actually works, right? So
first, can we talk a little bit about the double spend problem? I think it helps to frame things.
Sure. Yeah. Like, let's go into like the problems that what Bitcoin is solving here, right? So the double spend problem is a problem of computer science that it's really super interesting problem. Like even if you don't really know much about computer science, like just trying to like look at the components, it's a really interesting like puzzle.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, one area that Bitcoin sort of levered that a lot of these prior implementations had also done was this notion of like digital signatures, mm-hmm. where you as the owner of some account can provide a signature that shows that you're the owner, mm-hmm. and you can sign a transaction, right? So that any transaction that that comes from your account, it's easy to verify whether or not that's actually been signed by you. And so it provides that like self-sovereign, like ownership component of it. The issue comes down to like trying to reason about the world in a decentralized way. So when the double spend problem, we'll break it down. Say I want to send a Bitcoin to Karan, and I want to send a Bitcoin to, who's our favorite listener? Vlad. he'll be our first listener for this episode anyway. We can bleep it out after he listens. so maybe I only have one Bitcoin and I'm trying, and I sign transactions that send it to multiple people, right? That's the double spend problem. So in a centralized system, if I try to like send, if I sign a check and that gives you a dollar, and I sign another check that gives Vlad a dollar, you guys try to deposit them in your bank, if I mm-hmm. only have $1 in my account, whoever mm-hmm. goes first, that's going to be the one that clears, right? The other mm. one's going to bounce.
Mm. Yeah.
So how do
you... And hold on, hold on. Yeah, exactly. So let's pause right there, right? So in the situation you just described, where you have a check that... Or like, let's say you have a bank account that has $1 in it and you write two checks for a dollar each, right? Only one of them is going to clear, the first one, right? The only way that's enforced is a third party, that financial institution that says this person has a dollar in the bank and they can only check one, and they can only cash one of these, or they can only write a check for $1, right? So you need a trusted third party there, right? In the physical world.
It comes down to this question of like, who's first, right? How mm-hmm. do you measure first? How do you measure time? Right. And with that trusted third party, it's pretty easy. Mm-hmm. It's whichever request my bank sees first, that's the one that they're going to, that's the one they're going to honor.
Right.
Right. And they can, and it doesn't even necessarily have, it's not like verifiable even. Right. Mm-hmm. It's just whatever they say is first happened first.
Yep.
Right. So maybe they check all of the checking like requests from one bank, and then they check their checking requests from another, even though maybe you deposited your check first. Maybe your bank is the second one to get verified, and then it winds up not going through.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, I mean, the point being, like, if you have those lines of communication, if you have those trusted third parties, it's very easy to verify that, right? And the same actually applies in the digital world, right? The analog to digital parallel is pretty clean there. If you have these trusted third parties, like any data provider, right? If you, like, think about how easy it is to integrate, like, your bank with like any other like application on your phone, right? You just authorize it and they're like hooked up, right? So it's like, if you're providing access to data through these like big trusted third parties, centralized third parties, it's very easy to do that. The thing that's not easy to do is make these verifications without that trusted third party, right? How do you do that? How do I make sure that I'm not just continuing to spend the same dollar over and over and over again in a way where I don't have to trust anybody, right? Like, that's the problem that we're trying to solve here.
Yeah, I mean, it also comes down to like being able to measure what's first, right? And so when it comes to first, right, it's really, you know, in a sense, when you have a trusted third party, it's whatever they say goes, right? But in a decentralized system, people are going to see different things at different points in time, depending on their network speed, depending on their location within the world. So we need to make it so that if I sign a transaction, you know, if I sign two transactions and broadcast them in two different parts of the world, one of them needs to be like canonically first. We need to be able to reach consensus on the order of things. That's the core issue that proof of work is trying to solve. It's about temporal consensus, the order that transactions happened in. That's really what the blockchain is all about. It's about how do you establish consensus around an ordering of events in a decentralized manner.
Right. And so with that ordering of events, it provides a way for everybody to come to, you just mentioned a keyword, consensus, right? Everybody can agree on the way these events happened. And if we can agree on the way those events happened, we can agree on the state of everybody's kind of place in the network, right? So in this case, the state of their balances, right? Like how much each person has the ability to spend, like in the Bitcoin network, right? So how do we actually do that?
Yeah, and just quickly, it's worth noting that it doesn't necessarily have to be like a quote-unquote correct version of like the ordering of events, right? It just has to be one that people agree upon. Right. So you can imagine if I broadcast two transactions at exactly the same time from different locations in the world, different servers in the network are going to see those transactions at different times. Right. And so there's no there in that example, like there is no clear, actual, correct version of which one was first. They were both broadcast at the same time, but we still need to be able to reach a consensus about which one we're going to count as being first. So it's a social consensus, right?
Okay.
It's not a consensus as to the correct order of things. It's a canonical order of things.
Okay, so it's not an absolute truth, right? It's not like this definitely happened before this, or this definitely is the way things happened, but it's a way for us to all agree that these are the set of facts that we are all going to agree on, and they're set in stone. They can only happen if we all come to a consensus. They can only be recorded, at least, if we all come to a consensus.
Correct. So I think we've sort of stated the problem that we're trying to solve here. Let's get into how Bitcoin solves it.
Let's go.
You want to take the lead on this one, or should I?
I think you should start.
Okay, great. So Bitcoin introduces this notion of proof of work, right? And so the idea is you have these blocks, right? And each block contains a whole bunch of transactions, right? And then the next block will contain a reference to the block before it, mm-hmm. linking the blocks in a chain.
Mm-hmm.
What's up?
I was going to say, so let's reframe the problem, right? So let's start with the problem. We're trying to basically come up with a way to create a sequence of events that we can all agree on without having to trust any one third party, right? So how are we going to address that problem, right? Like, let's say we all start sending some transactions. I send some money to you. You send some money to a third person. Third person sends some money to me. I send some money back to that third person. Third person sends some money to you. Like, these are all being recorded somewhere, right? Like, I'm interacting with some kind of piece of software, which is the Bitcoin protocol. These transactions are then being sent somewhere. Like let's walk through exactly what's happening here, right? So these transactions all get recorded somewhere. Like, what's happening next?
Okay, so they enter something called the memory pool, the mempool, right?
Okay,
which is the pool of pending transactions mm-hmm. that people want to get included onto the ledger, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then you have people called miners, mm-hmm. And the miners are taking all of the incoming transactions,
mm-hmm.
ordering them into a list, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then running something called a hash function, right? Which mm-hmm. I would imagine every one of our listeners probably knows what that is. Mm-hmm. But it's like,
okay,
a one-way
function.
We'll get
into it after. Yeah,
yeah.
It's okay. So it goes into this hash function, and then?
And then the miners are trying to add a little something called a nonce to the list of transactions and hash it. Right. Mm. And so they try just kind of randomly, they try changing that nonce until the hash of that block with the nonce, winds up like having a certain property to it. So
basically they're trying mm-hmm. to solve a puzzle. They are trying to solve a predetermined puzzle that is going to lead to an output that has to look like a certain number. Like, the number we're trying to solve for basically is an output of a bunch of digits, and that number of a bunch of digits needs to start with a certain amount of zeros at the front, right? So it's like, this number might be like, I don't know, like 55 digits or whatever, and the first 28 digits, let's say, needs to all be zeros. And the way that's set is all programmatically in the Bitcoin code. That's what's called the difficulty adjustment.
Fun fact, it's actually not a certain number of leading zeros. It's it's just that the hash needs to be below a certain threshold.
In terms of what, like the weight of the actual like integer or whatever?
Yeah, so it's like the output needs to be below whatever threshold in order to be accepted as valid. So usually that starts with a whole bunch of leading zeros, but it might, you know, you might have 00001, that's good, but 00002 doesn't count, right?
I see. Okay.
So it's actually like a threshold that needs to be below. Yeah.
Okay. That's actually much easier to explain as well than leading zeros.
Yeah.
Okay. So. Let's keep walking this through, right? So a bunch of transactions happen, right? They all get sent to a shared list called the memory pool, for short, mempool, right? That mempool is then read by a group of people called the miners. Now, these miners, these are not like people with pickaxes, right? These are just computers. These are just like servers running the Bitcoin, like that, any kind of like mining kind of code, right? So this is code that looks for these kinds of transactions. Then the code, what it does is it takes all of those transactions, solves this puzzle, right? And it's looking for a certain output, an output that is a massive number, integer, that's below a certain level, just under a certain number, right? Whoever is able to solve that first is awarded the right to add that block, right, from the blockchain. That whole series of transactions is called a block. they are awarded the right to add that to the blockchain with that solution that they found, right? By solving the puzzle. Everybody else is able to verify that that solution is the right solution really easily. So it's part of this one-way hash function, right? You can actually look this up. It's called SHA-256, right? You can look up the way this is done on Google and just like try hashing a few things, right? What you get is a completely randomized output, right? So whoever gets this is like has put in a bunch of work to like try and solve this puzzle. They've solved it.
They're guess and checking, right?
It's literally just random guesses.
Transactions and then add a little bit, subtract a little bit, and they just guess until they get an output, one of these random outputs that is below that like threshold value. So in order to do it, they've expended some amount of resources to get it done, right? Electricity and computational power, right?
Yeah. So a couple of questions there, right? So then let's finish the rest of the process, right? They then are able to append that block to the blockchain. Everybody sees that. They can verify that these transactions are valid, that you've actually solved the puzzle. And then they accept that as the truth of the latest like block of transactions. And then they add it to their own kind of ongoing list for like the ongoing ledger, right? And then the next series of transactions comes in, and then that whole like process is repeated. Now, the last element of that is that when that block goes in, before it's finalized, or before that list of transactions actually is finalized, there's a little place where each miner adds an additional transaction to pay themselves as a reward for the work that they put in to add this block to the blockchain, right? For the work that they've done, right? This is why it's called proof of work, because every single miner is just basically running this series of like, just like hammering out like computations. Like basically what this like puzzle really looks like is they're taking what you described as a nonce, right? It's called a nonce. They take this whole series of transactions, they add the nonce. The nonce might be like zero, right? And then they put that together, they hash it, and then try to get a number below the specified number. If that doesn't work, then they'll try the number one, then they'll try the number two, then they'll try, like, they'll literally just keep trying. And then if you see a mining farm, like they're called farms because there's literally just like thousands, tens of thousands of these computers just like running, whirring in these big, big, big fields, like out in Texas and North Dakota, and crazy places with tons of land. It's wild to see, but that is the actual process of how the Bitcoin network takes in transactions, adds them to the network, and secures them, right? So, like that's in a nutshell, like that is what the Bitcoin network is doing, right? The questions that I have for you from that point are, why does it do that, right? How does that actually provide security for the network? This whole thing is about security. It's about securing the network so that nobody can tamper with it, right? So how does that whole process actually provide security for the network? And then how does every other miner, how does every other participant in the network kind of like move forward and agree that that last person, it is like a verified person, that they've done the right thing, and how do they all kind of come to consensus in a real world sense, like in a networking kind of sense?
Good questions. So one thing that I think is kind of important, right, is that because you just have to like guess and check a lot, it's very infrequent to come up with a correct answer, right? Mm. To come up with the golden nonce, right? Mm-hmm. The nonce that when you hash it along with the transactions will get you that that output.
Yeah. So right now,
below the threshold.
Yeah. Right now it's like, if you get that nonce correct, right? You get paid like 6.25 Bitcoin, right? So it's quite a bit.
That's like $6.25 million at my end of 2026 price target.
financial advice.
So you're doing it because you get paid, right? Mm-hmm. And it's very infrequent that a miner will stumble upon the correct answer, right? So generally speaking, you get a new Bitcoin or a new block added to the blockchain mm-hmm. every 10 minutes.
Yeah, right? Exactly. So that's $100,000 coming into the network every 10 minutes. Like this is new Bitcoin being released. So this kind of mining mechanism, right? This is how any new Bitcoin has ever been created. This is how any new Bitcoin will ever be created. And it will be created at a decreasing rate, right? So mining started the very first block, right? Satoshi started running the software, started mining, right? The Bitcoin network. Anybody who wanted to use it could send transactions to anybody who was mining the blockchain. Initially, the first transaction was sent from Satoshi to Hal Finney. Right. So, and Satoshi was also the miner, right? So Satoshi got paid for mining the blockchain. And he was the main miner for like the first many blocks. Satoshi owned 1 million Bitcoin approximately from all the mining in the early days, right? You can actually see that people have done a really deep kind of analysis, like cryptographic analysis on all the wallets that Satoshi owns from the mining. And it's about like a million Bitcoin worth, and it's never been moved. Right. So all the mining that's ever been, or all the Bitcoin that's ever been created has come from mining. Right. And initially the payout for mining one block was 50 Bitcoin. Right. So every block that was mined, you would get 50 Bitcoin in return for mining. And people started mining just from their computers, like, you know, their MacBook Pros or whatever. Like you could just mine very easily from your computer and you could get paid quite a bit doing so, like at least in Bitcoin. Like I know a lot of people who were mining in college who were just mining, you know, just as hobbyists. So it's a very common thing to do. And then the market started to get more sophisticated, but that's kind of how the like flow of new Bitcoin works, right? And then the amount that gets distributed for every single block gets cut in half. I don't know how many blocks it is, but it's a certain amount of blocks that it gets cut in half, which equates to about 4 years. So about every 4 years, the amount of Bitcoin that gets paid out to miners for mining a single block, it's cut in half. So initially it was 50, then it was 25, then it was 12.5, and now it's 6.25. So that's a lot of people attribute the halvening, right? The cutting in half of the Bitcoin rewards to the rise in price, because it makes Bitcoin more and more valuable. It makes it more and more scarce as time goes on. Eventually, this halvening will lead to the supply completely running out. In about 2140, there will only ever be 21 million Bitcoin in the end. A bulk of the supply, most like 98%, 99% of the supply will be finished in 2040. So about, you know, 18 years from now. So that's a pretty interesting kind of thing to look at. But that's kind of the way the supply of the Bitcoin, the actual currency, the tokens, are released on the Bitcoin capital B network.
Yep. So
Bitcoin tokenomics, baby.
So, you know, while we're on this topic, we should talk about, you know, one property of Bitcoin that people point to a lot is that it's not inflationary, right? There's a fixed supply cap. Mm. And for that reason, Bitcoin tends to resonate pretty hard with people that are, you know, effectively like gold bugs in the physical world. They love Bitcoin in the digital world, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's guaranteed to be scarce, unlike central bank currencies, right?
Mm-hmm.
So going back to the blocks coming out every 10 minutes or so, that's helpful in and of itself, right? Because it gives people a fair amount of time to come to a consensus, to hear about the latest block, right? And so when a new block happens, you have a fair amount of wiggle room, like a grace period between that happening and the next block getting mined. And so it decreases contention for like the adding the next block at whatever block height or like whatever number block you're at, simply by being a little bit slow, right? So the, you know, if you think about consensus, the scenario you're trying to avoid is two miners trying to add a block at the same height that has maybe conflicting transactions. So maybe block A would have a transaction where I send you Bitcoin. Maybe block B has a transaction where I send someone else Bitcoin. At that point, you have what's called a fork, right? Because you have this nice linear chain of block, 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 and then you have a split in the network, a fork. And so at that point, miners have to make a choice, right? Every block references the block before it. So you need to clarify as you're mining which block you're trying to extend, right? Which side of the fork you're trying to extend here.
Okay.
And so that's just kind of random, right? It's however miners want to do it, right? So let's say, you know, half the miners start building off of block A and half the miners start building off of block B, right? Whichever one gets lucky and finds the golden nonce and like gets and adds the next block to the chain, that will make that side of the fork one block longer, right? And then you could continue this process, right? Maybe it gets to be two blocks longer, three blocks longer. At this point, the miners have a clear economic incentive, right? At some point, the shortest block is probably, or the shorter side of the fork is probably just going to get thrown away. You don't want to, use computational resources and electrical power and expenditures to try to extend a side of the fork that's just not going to be accepted by consensus. Your incentive is to build off of the longer chain, right? And because everyone's individual incentive is to do that, the collective incentive becomes to very quickly throw away conflicting blocks, right? So, you know, there are two core aspects that make it easy to come to a social consensus here. The first is that Bitcoin is slow, that you get a new block every 10 minutes. You can imagine if we got a new block every 2 seconds, then blocks A and B would get mined and everyone would say, okay, I'm going to either extend A or B. And then maybe you get blocks that extend A and B, we'll call them A1, B1. And then you quickly get A2, A3, B2, B3. And the network would have trouble figuring out which side of the fork actually is the longer side, A or B.
Right?
And at that point you just have chaos because any of the transactions in A might be invalid if we can't come, if we come to the consensus that B is the real, is the canonical longest chain. Any of the transactions in B would be considered invalid if we come to the consensus that A is the valid chain. So we need to sort of slow it down, right? That's sort of the first thing. The second thing is that everyone has the selfish incentive to build off of the longest chain, because that's the one that's going to have the higher probability of getting built on.
Right.
So one interesting thing that I learned doing research for today's episode is that the transaction that mints new Bitcoin, the Coinbase transaction, has a special property. The newly minted Bitcoin can't be spent for 100 blocks.
Interesting.
Okay. Yeah.
So it just can't be moved at all.
It just can't be moved at all. There's a special thing in the software that prevents that UTXO from being spent.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. And so as a miner, you want to build, you only want to expend your hash power on a side of the chain that you think is going to still be around 100 blocks from now. Right. So it's a self-enforcing social consensus where it's like, I want to build off of the longest chain. Why do I want to build off the longest chain? Because everyone else wants to build off of the longest chain too. And so it's more likely that my block will get included $100 or now, and then I can spend that Bitcoin.
Here's the thing. It's a really, really genius system, the way this thing was designed. It really can't work without this incentive of the release of tokens coming out, right? And it's also worth pointing out that initially these tokens had no value, right? There was no market to trade these for US dollars, to trade these for goods and currencies, to trade these for literally anything, right? So, the incentive was kind of inherent to the system itself, right? Like, you would only be mining if you wanted to use the network and gain more of these tokens to then trade them with other people, or like build apps that would, like, I don't know, facilitate the, I don't know, use of Bitcoin in some way. Like, I don't know, people were building faucets and dice games and stuff like that early on. So, it's an inherent kind of value unlock that's like spread through the network, right? With this mining incentive, and kind of like the game theory is such that it creates this social consensus where people are incentivized to keep the chain going and also incentivized to act honestly, right? Like, it's more economically advantageous for you to just act honestly, try and mine the longest chain, validate the transactions properly, and collect the mining reward than it is for you to try and get through like a false transaction that's then going to not get validated, and then you're just losing money.
Yeah, not only a false transaction, right? But really to try to subvert the consensus at all. So subverting consensus is like when you fork the network, right? So by trying to add, let's say block number 3 was just added to the chain. Mm-hmm. If you continue mining, you might be able to mine a competing block number 3, mm-hmm. right? But you don't have the incentive to do that. Mm-hmm. Because by the time you get that block, someone else might get block number 4 building off of the canonical block number 3. Mm. So it's this game theoretical like convergence, mm-hmm. to the actual like longest chain. Mm. The economic reward is always there for you to behave as a good actor in the system that tries to continue in the like consensus world, because you're wasting resources if you try to subvert consensus.
Yeah. It's very fascinating. Like, so much of this, it works because of this like social layer, right? Like, it's designed in a way to keep the social consensus like going.
Yeah, all of this exists to create that decentralized consensus on the order of transactions in the chain, mm-hmm. right? And this is all to solve this double spend problem, mm-hmm. right? So that you know exactly the order in which events happened. We should point out one thing just as a side note. It's not just the block rewards that incentivize you, right? Because a lot of our listeners are thinking like, okay, great, Bitcoin stops working in 130 years, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you also get transaction fees. So each transaction pays a little bit of a fee to the miner. Mm-hmm. And so after the block rewards run out, the miners will have to subsist on transaction fees.
Yeah.
Today, the average transaction fee in a Bitcoin block is about $1.50 mm-hmm. worth of Bitcoin, or $10,500 at my price target, and $15,000 at my price target at the end of 2025.
Definitely financial advice.
The incentive will always be there to mine in a way that adheres to maintaining social consensus rather than subverting it.
Yeah.
That's really the key thing here, is the economic incentives are always there for you to maintain consensus on the state of the blockchain.
Yeah. Yep. So, Matt, at this point, do you want to walk through like what a block might look like on, like a very granular level, or should we just go into kind of like a big picture discussion about Bitcoin?
Why don't we just jump through like what a block actually is.
Okay.
Because I think it does make it a little bit more tangible.
Yeah. Let's lay it down, right? So we discussed what the problem is, like why we're solving this problem, why this thing was even created. Then we talked about the like technological underpinnings of what makes this happen, right? And then we walk through like how it happens. Now let's look at what the like software actually is, like what it does, right? Like line by line, like what does each block entail? Welcome to What is in a Bitcoin Block by the Decent Crypto Podcast. Matt, over to you.
I hope this is a recurring segment where we just read block by block in the gym. We could do it. They only happen every 10 minutes.
Let me do my read in again, so it's going to look better on our YouTube segment. All right, Matt. This is Block by Block by the Decent Crypto Podcast. Over to you, Matt.
What's in a Bitcoin block? There's some interesting stuff and some less interesting stuff, right? So the first thing is less interesting. It's called a magic number. And in software, a magic number is just like any arbitrary number that's chosen to make things work. In this case, it's like a network identifier, right? So this is like some seemingly random like letters and numbers that tell you that this block is a Bitcoin block. It is 0x9d9b4bef9.
Nice.
Every Bitcoin block starts with that data. It doesn't have to, it could be whatever. It just has to be the same.
Okay. Right?
And it just happens that we've chosen this. The next piece of the Bitcoin block is the block size that specifies how big the following block is. Right. So currently, like, and this is political, currently the maximum allowable size is a megabyte. There were attempts to like create different versions of Bitcoin in the past that extended this. There was Bitcoin Cash was 8 megabytes.
I think it was just 2 initially, and then they raised it to 4 and then raised it to 8 again, maybe. I'm not a big Bitcoin Cash follower, so I'm not too aware.
Next deep dive.
So there are many attempts at this. There is a book called The Block Size Wars if you really want to go deep.
Cannot recommend it. I found it kind of dry, even for me.
Yeah, I liked it.
So the next piece is a very, very crucial part. It's called the block header. So this is something that like our audience has probably heard of before. So
maybe not. What is it?
The block header contains like important metadata about the block.
Okay.
And this will really tie into like the structure of the blockchain itself. So the first thing in a block header is the version, right? So V1 as of January 2009, V2 2012, V3 2015, V4 2015 again, I think.
And what did these versions represent? Like, can you not run old versions? Can you what is the purpose of these new versions?
So when Bitcoin, when like the Bitcoin core, software, has like an update that wouldn't be backwards compatible, the community as a whole comes to a consensus around which version they're going to adopt. Right. And so generally these are just kind of like useful updates to the software. They're not contentious. But it's important that everybody knows that like, a V2 block wouldn't get accepted by the network today. It would have to be a V4 block, right?
Okay.
And it just like allows for like they added an opcode at one point. They like added a little bit of required data. I think block size was not a required field for a while. And so in like in V4 or V3, they started to make that required so that people would kind of know when they see a block, whether or not to just like reject it offhand. Right.
Are these hard forks every time these new versions don't accept old versions? Right. If version 2 is not accepted, like, is that a hard fork or like, is that a whole separate thing?
They're hard forks, but I don't think a hard fork has to lead to a new version, if that makes sense. They tend to be sort of more like core pieces around the structure of a block. When those change, they will update the version number.
Okay, I see.
So first the version number, then the next component of the block header is the previous block's hash. So this is really important, right? Because when you're mining a block, you need to know which block height you're mining. Are you mining block number 3 or block number 4? Right. And so you the way that you tell the network, here is the order of, you know, here is this block's location in the timeline, is by specifying which block it comes after. This is the piece of it that chains the blocks together, right? So block number 4 in its block header will have the hash of block number 3. And in its header, it has the hash of block number 2, et cetera. So this is like crucially important because it establishes where in the chain the block is meant to be.
Okay.
It's also crucially important because the way that this works is every block, if you tampered with its data even a little bit, it would change that block's hash, right?
Yep.
And so you can validate the integrity of the full history just by looking at the data and the hash of that data for every block, right?
Yep.
Because if I replaced, if I tried to give you a false copy of the Bitcoin blockchain, if you know the current like block hash, then, you know, if I tried to like swap a transaction, you'd be able to see that. You'd say, hang on a second. Your current block hash doesn't match my current block hash because the change in data from block 1 flows all the way through to block whatever we're on now. Because each block has to have the previous block's hash.
And so this is another really easy way to like verify, like without spending any computational resources really, right? Because the hash is like like you said, it's just a chain, right? Like the chain of hashes will just tell the story.
Yeah, and so the current block hash, it references the previous block hash, which references that block's data, which references the previous block hash, which references that block's data. So just by knowing the current block hash, you can verify anybody's copy of the Bitcoin blockchain just by looking at like which block hash that one has at the end. The other thing is computationally, right? If you try to change the data in one block, you mine it so that you can get like that magic or the golden nonce that solves that puzzle, right? You would then also have to solve the puzzle of the next block because that block's hash would have changed. And then, so the next block, you know, because it has the previous block's hash in it, its hash would have changed, right? And so its puzzle solution would have changed.
Yeah.
And so,
tampering any piece would just tamper every subsequent piece, right? So if you like tried to go back and change anything, it would change everything following it.
Yeah. So to like fabricate a transaction anywhere in the chain, you would have to expend the computational power to fabricate the entire remaining parts of the chain.
Yeah. And redo all of the same work, right? To solve for the new hash, right? And then keep like basically redo the whole chain, the whole state of the chain afterwards.
Yeah, and it's not just the work of like one miner, right? It's the work of the entire network.
Right. You need to basically take over more than half of the network and get them to come to that consensus. And whatever that amount costs.
Yeah, you need more compute. You need more than half of the total compute of the Bitcoin network. And then you need it, and then some, right? Because you have to do it for the full history since the transaction that you're trying to change or alter or add or whatever. And so it just makes it computationally infeasible to reverse a transaction or remove a transaction, right? This is what leads to transaction finality.
Yeah. So this is this core piece, like saving these hashes, is what leads to a lot of the security of the network, right? Because this, like, just by being able to read these things, everybody can come to the like safe and secure conclusion that their transactions are still valid, still there, right? You know, like historical transactions going all the way back, right? Like, because if anything in the history of the chain changes, the whole state of the chain will change going forward from that point, right? So yeah, it will basically cause like a series of you know, like events that cause red flags.
Yeah, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
That is like how the chain provides security for its users. That's how we know that our transactions are secure, that our transactions in the past are going to let us, like, you know, like have that like finality of like those transactions, and that we can spend the funds that we have in our wallets in the future.
Yeah. And so it's also what leads to like something called probabilistic finality, right? So if you think about like the latest block, right, in order to like swap that one out with like a different block, you would only need to expend enough compute power to mine one block, right? But if you're trying to change a transaction that's say two blocks back, then you need to mine two blocks. Mm. You need to expend the computational power to do that.
Mm-hmm.
We try to do three blocks back, then you need to expend the computational power to mine three blocks, yeah, right? And so you can generally, you know, after a certain point, you can say, okay, it's pretty much infeasible that an attacker would be able to alter the state of the chain or the chain's history.
So right? let's go through what an attacker would have to do, right? If they wanted to change the state of the chain, so let's say an hour ago, right? Six blocks, right? That's kind of what all exchanges use as their standard for finality. Once a transaction is on the blockchain for six blocks, people will generally release their funds. Like exchanges will release their funds and consider them final. So what would an attacker have to do to change a transaction from six blocks ago to like divert those funds to you or to double spend or to do anything, right? Like what would their process look like?
Yeah. So say the attacker sends Bitcoin to an exchange, right? And then they try it and then they wait six blocks. The exchange releases the Bitcoin. They sell it for dollars, take it out to their bank account.
Mm-hmm.
Now they're trying to take it all back and change history on the Bitcoin blockchain to say, delete that transaction. So that it does, that it looks like they never sent it to the exchange, right? First, they have to mine block, let's call it T minus six, right? Then they have to mine, and then, you know, that will output some block hash. Then they take that block hash, and then they have to mine the altered T minus five. Then they have to mine the altered T minus four, three, two, and one.
Yeah.
But keep in mind, in the meantime, the network continues running.
Yeah.
Right.
So they have to do that for each block. They have to recompute all of the following transactions, put them into a block, hash them, find the actual nonce that like matches the difficulty or matches the, you know, is below the number that required. Do all of that for each block after, you know, six blocks ago. They have to take over and the reason more they have than to half,
do that, right?
Well, they have to do that for more than half the computational power of the network, not just like one miner, right? They have to propagate that across more than half the network so that half of the network will come to that conclusion that this is true, and then get the rest of the whole network to then come to that same conclusion, right? That's what creates consensus.
Yeah, they have to do blocks T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, and 1 is because we pass T minus 6's hash to T minus 5.
Mm-hmm.
Then we pass that hash to T minus 4.
Yeah.
So we need to like create a whole alternate world, right?
We need to create a completely new blockchain and then convince everybody that this is the real blockchain.
Yeah, which if we were able to make it long enough is what would happen by default.
Mm-hmm.
The issue is that the whole rest of the world is also still mining off of what they see as the longest chain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. So in the meantime, let's say you have enough hash power that it's equal to about 50% of the network, right? Mm-hmm. Or it's equal to 100% of the current network, mm-hmm. right? probabilistically, you would say, okay, by the time you've mined 6 blocks, the rest of the network has also mined 6 blocks, mm-hmm. right? And so you're actually stuck at that point. You need more than 50%. You need 51%. And even then, it will take you a while to catch up.
Mm. Yeah. So what does this really do? This provides security, right? This provides the security that for anybody to actually change transactions to like basically fuck with our transactions, fuck with our money, it's going to cost a prohibitive amount, like an unfeasible number. I think the last number that people were quoting was like in the tens of billions of dollars or something, right? To actually start like what it's called is a 51% attack on the chain. To 51% attack the Bitcoin blockchain, it was like in the tens of billions of dollars, right? So that's what gives you the assurance that your transactions are final, or secure, are going to be on chain forever when you actually place a transaction. That's the value of the Bitcoin network.
Yep. It gives you this immutable decentralized ledger, right?
Mm.
Where you know that when you've received funds by about 6 blocks in, you can feel extremely confident that that transaction that gave you those funds will never get reversed.
Mm.
And so Satoshi in the white paper, gives, a pretty good example, right? Gives some like the last page or so, gives some stats, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if an attacker has 30% of the network hash power, right? There's only a 1% chance that they would be able to revert a transaction by the time it's 15 blocks deep, right? In order to get, you know, 0.1% chance, if the attacker controls even 45% of the network, you can still feel pretty confident that by the time, the attacker controls 45% of the total hash power of the network. You have, by the time your transaction is 340 blocks deep, you have 0.1% chance of getting it reverted, right? Now that's a while, that's like 22 days, right? But it's still pretty good considering that's 45% of the total hash power of the network.
Yeah. Yeah. Even if you own almost half the network, it's still almost impossible for you to attack.
Anything older than 22 days is, has a 0.1% chance of you being able to attack it. And just probabilistically, like, would you really play a game where you had 0.1% chance of winning if it was going to cost you tens of billions of dollars?
Yeah.
No.
So Matt, this whole discussion has been around security, around transactions, like transactional security, right? Provided in a decentralized manner by this software, you know, network. But why do we really love Bitcoin? Matt, why do you love Bitcoin?
Bitcoin is pure decentralization to me, right? And a lot of people are kind of bearish on proof of work, right? There's a lot of people out there that say that proof of work is wasteful, that it's boiling the oceans, that it's like contributing to climate change, that it has like that Bitcoin uses the same amount of electricity as many, many small countries.
Mm-hmm.
All of those things might be true.
Mm-hmm.
But the value it delivers is this pure mechanism for decentralized consensus. And to me, that's necessary, right? That's like an opt out. That's an eject button from centralization that nothing else in the world really provides today.
Yeah.
Right. It is so beautiful and so pure in what it accomplishes, which is decentralized consensus. And to me, the notion that we as a species can coordinate something like that, that should be impossible, right? Like decentralized anything is difficult. Decentralized consensus is difficult. Decentralized consensus when there's like value at risk should be impossible.
Mm-hmm.
It's a miracle that we can do this.
Yeah.
Right. And it reflects human ingenuity that we can design a system so simple, so pure, so elegant that it just does what it's supposed to. And no matter what happens in the crypto world, Bitcoin keeps making blocks and you can get a transaction through if you pay for it. And that's beautiful. Why do you love Bitcoin?
I don't think I can top that. I'm just going to leave with one quote from Satoshi's white paper that touches on exactly what you just said. The network is robust in its unstructured simplicity. I also love Bitcoin because it just works and it provides a real value. People always talk about, you know, what is this thing actually doing? It is doing something really valuable, right? Like people in the West, people in America might not appreciate what it's really doing, but in a lot of places, you can't have a place that you can put your wealth, that you can just execute transactions, you know, easily in like feasibly, right? And I'm not saying that this is perfect. I'm not saying that there are even many places in the world where this is valuable. I'm just saying that the technology itself is a valuable technology. And it's up to us to take that and build more on top of it, make it easier for people to access, make wallets more widespread, make more technologies that, you know, use this as infrastructure, right? So that is all up to us. But I love it for the same reasons that you just mentioned, right? That the decentralized properties of it, the ability for anybody to access and own something, a digital property, right? Digital property that leads to like true ownership that nobody can mess with. I think those are all really, really cool things that we've created and that Satoshi has created and gifted us with. So I love it for all those same reasons. And I think that people are foolish, if you ask me, to discount this as a technology and as a vehicle for creating you know, opportunities for people. Frankly. So I think there's a lot to be built on top of Bitcoin. And I think there's a lot of potential to be unlocked with Bitcoin. And I actually think that we're going to get back to that in the next couple of years. I think that's our both of our hot takes, actually. So I'm excited for the future of Bitcoin. This is only part one. We're going to do a few more episodes on this topic about layer twos, about scaling, about applications being built on top of this. So stay tuned. Hope you enjoyed this deep dive on the Bitcoin protocol. We will be back in a few days with a recap of everything that happened this week. Have a good week, everybody. Have a good Thanksgiving. Enjoy with your families. Till then, stay decent.
None of this was financial advice, legal advice, investment advice, or any other kind of advice. If you're looking for advice, you are definitely in the wrong place. Until next time, stay decent.